Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to Books Boys, live from the Grand Library, the Dean and PJ.
It's PJ.
Hello there.
I'm the Dean, and we are the Books Boys.
The one and only.
And this is the Books Boys show. Get it? Buy it? Books.
Books. Still a mystery to me. I've been looking in my bathroom cupboard looking for books, but is that the right place to find Herodotus and the like, Dean?
Because I think it is. Find them.
Okay.
I think if you open it like a scroll, you'll find some round paper. You open it up, and there might be some markings on there, and that might be Herodotus. Okay. I think
invisible ink. Okay, fair enough.
It's hard to say. The technology eludes me.
It's very hard. It's paper, you know. Paper. I mean, I was looking for that play the other day. You know that O'Neill play in the forest. I forgot which tree it was on, and then I lost, you know, the branches and the words and. Got all very
It's tricky.
But then I got confused. I thought it was a Beckett play, no, because it was very absurdist. And I thought that was the point of the play, like getting lost between the branches, the words between the leaves, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, it's tricky because they tell us that the books, they come on paper, they come from trees. We go out to the paper store, we look at the toilet paper, we go to the forest, we don't see the books.
And they say like it comes from the minds of people, including dead people. I think it's very macabre. So how do I imagine that? It just spills out of the brain, kind of onto the leaves. What's going on there? This is getting very dark, Dean.
It's a confusing topic, man. It's a confusing topic. Do you know where I was today? I was in the Maclay Library at Queen's University, which you'll remember from our old days.
I love that and library.
I didn't realize before that I was looking at all these books that have, you know, history and philosophy. If I would just go up one more story, they've got actual novels. English novels, French novels, Spanish novels. I never knew that before.
Did I know that?
In the decade that I've been going there, no.
Yeah, and a good selection. I love all the books there.
Never noticed. But some of the stuff, man, I got into this aisle, and it was an entire aisle of early English texts. So we're talking like very, very early. You can't read it. It's old English. Like, yeah, you know, it doesn't make sense. And the titles will just be like, you know, description of a nunnery in 10 volumes. Like, I can't cope with that, you know?
Description of a nunnery. Imagine reading that in your free time, you know? Imagine being busy and then squeezing in time to read the full 10 volumes.
And then I feel bad, and maybe I'm hard on myself. There's, you know, because I do read the history, and we'll get to that in a minute, but some of the stuff, I just can't do it, man. Like, I'm loving my Greek history, and then it'll be, you know, people like Strabo or Pausanias who wrote geographies. So I can't read a 2 or 3 volume set just describing the landscape. Like, I can't do that, man. That's really, really dull.
Some people call that art, you know. Yeah, Walt Whitman would have a thing to say about that.
I guess, you know, and then Plutarch's Moralia. Well, that's 16 volumes. Like, I don't have the time for that, you know.
You get the impression that all these people, they had an abundance of time, you know.
Had a lot of time, yeah, to write 16 volumes. And in fact, it's 15 volumes, and then the 16th volume is just the index. The index gets a whole volume. It's ridiculous.
Imagine saving money for a few months, buying those volumes, and then you miss out on volume 16. You know, you just wanted that index. That's the main book. That's where it gets funky.
I really want to read it, you know, but it's just sometimes it's too much, and I've got a limited time for, you know, and it's too much.
And you've got a high tolerance, you know.
I do.
You got a very high tolerance.
In fact, I'll go straight into that, because the first thing I read this month was Herodotus. Now, I actually read three books, because this was a multi-volume set. It was actually a four-volume set, but I gave up after three. There's only so much I can do here. A three-volume set of Herodotus' histories. Now, if you don't know, some people call Herodotus the father of history. Those people are wrong. That is Thucydides. Well, Herodotus essentially, you know, he was the first great historian. But I'm going to give a few quotes, which will give you an example as to why I don't think he's a real historian. And this is not something radical I'm saying. I think a lot of people do agree with me in the academic world. He mixes in a bit too much legend, a bit too much fable, a bit too much mythology for it to be real history. Whereas Thucydides, who's the next great historian, is pure scientific history, short-term causes, long-term causes, effects, you know, what we would call history today. Herodotus is like, well, this is like an episode of Game of Thrones at times, you know, and it's just a little bit...
Probably more entertaining, though, is it? That's it. It's more like it's more literary, kind of. Yeah,
it's like halfway between Thucydides and Homer. You know, like it's got that.
Right, okay.
It is entertaining. You know, but I'm going to give you an example. So one of the first stories we see in it. Mm-hmm. Now it happened that this chap Candaules was in love with his own wife, which apparently was unusual.
That's
and
very
unworthy.
Unusual. Yeah, that's a strange thing to happen.
So he says to his friend, you know, basically, My wife's incredibly attractive, so you should probably try to see her naked. So he contrives this scenario where his friend is like sneaking into his room and hiding behind some, like, you know, clothes screens, trying to see the wife naked. And the wife realizes. So then she says to the chap afterwards, Gyges, she says, look, I know what you did. I know that it wasn't your fault. So here's what we're going to do. Either we're going to kill you, or you kill my husband, the king, and you take his throne. And then that's what happens.
Radical
so
solution.
It's, you know, it's Game of Thrones stuff here, you know.
It's payback, you know what I mean? You don't do that, guys. Just anyone listening in and having that exact idea this moment was your pal. You don't do that, you know. I mean, you know, you fall in love with your wife, stick with your wife. Don't, like, tell your neighbor to have a peek in, you know. Don't do that. So there's my moral comment. That's my moral comment. I could be writing the notes for these books. Modern Notes by PJ.
That'd be something I would buy.
Yeah.
Then we have another example where Croesus says, you know, he gets some vision or dream that his son's going to die in a fight. So he never lets his son go to the fight. And they eventually tell him, you have to let him go to the fight. So they let him go. And he sends this chap and he says, I want you to be his guardian. So the guardian immediately shoots an arrow, which goes stray and kills the son, arrow to the head. He's like, oh, no, I was going to protect him. And I shot him in the head, you know? So he kills the son. Like, just all this weird stuff is happening.
He's not
going to
get
a
job anytime soon again in that position.
No.
Might have
and
to
then
change.
We get a scene where just all this crazy stuff. So, for example, but mixed in with real history. The stuff about, like, Hyrcus giving the laws to the Spartans and all this kind of stuff that is probably real, maybe a bit skewed, a bit mythical, but still there's some basis for it, you know? So it's weird. And then we have massive segues for hundreds of pages where we move away from Greece and talk about ancient Egypt. And, you know, and then it gets really boring and it's just talking about, like, burial customs and all this kind of stuff. And then we get a lot of geography and a lot of stuff about the food that the people would eat in Scythia and Egypt and Persia. It's just a bit all over the place. It's not well constructed, Herodotus. That's my criticism for Herodotus. Take notes. But one of my favorite stories is, and again, you'll see why it's more like Homer than Thucydides. They have a nice scene where they say to this chap, I think the chap annoys him or whatever. So he says, don't worry. Look, it's all fine. We'll have a banquet. And then he goes and kills the chap's son, cuts him up, and feeds him to his dad. You know, like, this is out of Homer. This is not history, you know?
Well, tell George or Martin, you know, just, you're not, you know, you're not that original. This stuff already existed, right?
Yeah. And then after being forced to eat his own son, he then says, well, I guess this guy's not going to hold a grudge. I'll put him in command of my armies. It's ridiculous. You know, it doesn't make any sense.
Look, the way you're selling it sounds like a very amusing, if not absurdist, kind of book. But yeah, it doesn't sound
it was funny, yeah. There's a bit where they want to say Persians are better than everybody else, so we're going to take a Persian kid and another kid, put them in a room, and whichever one develops speech the quickest, it, you know, and then the Persian's the best because, well, of course, it's, you know, it's just weird stuff happening. It's just a random mixed match of stuff going from Greece to Persia to Scythia, all over the place. You know, people killing their sisters and marrying their sisters and all this
stuff. Usual Coronation Street material.
Yeah, the usual Coronation Street material.
That's where they got the other stuff from.
But then it's mixed with like real history. That's the strangest thing about it, you know. But look, I'm not going to dwell on it because although I spent 2 weeks reading three volumes, you know, those are the highlights. The rest is quite. There's parts that are really funny and there's parts that are boring. But I think that people don't really want to hear too much about Herodotus, sadly. So I'm going to leave it there. I mean, do you have any thoughts on that? I took copious notes, man. I've got so many notes on this, and then I thought, no one wants this, like, you know.
Just too much. I'm just imagining. This could be another episode of I was going to say of the God. I can't even think straight. This could be. Now this has to be a separate kind of program. This, you know, you could just talk about this, but just by yourself, a monthly episode, just talking about your comments on Herodotus and all these lads, you know, and all the other chaps.
Yes. Here's another interesting one. This Persian chap, cuts his own nose and ears off.
Well, you know,
spurting blood everywhere, so that he can go to the Babylonians and say, "Look what they did to me. I'm not on their side anymore. Come in." And then, like, open all the gates and let the soldiers in, you know? Like, did it to himself, just, you know, self-sacrifice.
It's just normal stuff. Yeah. It's
normal everyday history. This is why I don't respect Herodotus as much as Thucydides.
Okay, fair enough. Okay. It's just normal customs, you know? This is what you do every day, you know?
Normal stuff. This is how I spend my Saturday nights, you know. That's just cutting off my own ears and various things, you know.
Marrying sisters, killing sisters, then deciding to marry again. Yeah, it's just all over the place, yeah.
Here's one of my favorite pieces. They're talking about I think this is about the Egyptians, and they say when he dies, what they then need to do is, so in the open space around the body of the king, they kill and bury one of his concubines, first killing her by strangling. Lord. Then they also kill and bury his cupbearer, his cook, his groom, his lackey, his messenger, some of his horses. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, because
there's some truth in it. You know, it is history, but it's just a bit wild, some of the stuff, you know.
That's crazy. But really, my comment is, the interesting is, and my comment is that when you everything's been written already, all this crazy stuff, when people think, well, that's really radical and violent, what was already written, you know, X years ago. So I mean,
yeah,
so it's interesting to find that. Well, like when we're talking about Lao Tzu, for example, as well, you know, 2500 year old philosophy, I think, is still relevant. So a lot of it has been done already.
Well, it has, yeah.
It does make me want to read, I'll tell you this, it does make me want to read bits of it, though. You kind of half sold it to me. I kind of sold it to me in a sense of, I'll read what was funny and then just leave the rest.
I think if you could just read the highlights, you know, it's...
Well, you can edit it. You can do a small selection of the most amusing texts. And
Man, I'll get right to it. When I'm not podcasting and making music and painting and doing Orwell classes and history classes and art classes, Orwell, I'll get right to it.
Orwell and Ireland classes, very specific, very niche. And you were... I'll just comment this to everyone out there. You're in a concert recently in Madrid, where while waiting for the concert to start, you were attending an online Greek history course.
I was in the arena with my headset plugged in on my phone, attending virtually a Plutarch's Greek Lives class. My schedule had too many clashes, and I'd gone all the way to Madrid for this concert as well, which is ridiculous.
And you're probably reading Herodotus at the same time, weren't you? Like, you know, trying to
I had
split
him with me.
Yeah, you had him with you at the concert.
No, no, I didn't bring it to the concert, but I had it with me in Madrid. Do you know a quick anecdote, something that was quite funny, because I did a tour in Madrid and the guy was telling me all these things. And, you know, it's always good to get a local tour guide to have a bit of quirkier knowledge. Yeah. Some of the stuff he told me to do, you know, he was like, oh, you see in there, you can go there tomorrow and they'll let you in. Now, there will be a policeman there and he will say you can't go in. But if you just persuade him, he will let you in and you can see the inside of this lovely house. And I'm like, okay, I mean, I might not do that. Like, I might not go and argue with a policeman tomorrow, you know. And then he said, and this church, they've got some nuns in it and they make these lovely biscuits. But you will have to go not to the front door, but if you sneak around to this little back door and you go in and you walk through this dark corridor with no one in it, and you'll eventually come to the end and you'll not see the nuns. But if you knock on a thing and put some money down, someone might put biscuits. And I'm like, what? That's amazing, but like, I'm not doing
that. That's actually true, the second one.
I know, but I'm not going to do that by myself, you know?
The second one I've heard of, and the first one just sounds like he was kind of trying to get you to break in to a random house, and maybe the police will be okay about it.
Yeah. That's the fear. And I'm just thinking, look, both of these might be perfectly legit, but like, I'm not going to do this. I'm only in the country for 2 days. I'm not going to get a fight with policemen and nuns, you know?
Policemen and nuns. Sounds like a P.G. Woodhouse novel. Oh, God.
I'm going to get to my next novel, man. I read, I finished up my Orwell cycle. So I finished my Orwell class today, by the way, but I finished my Orwell cycle of reading, and it was his least popular novel, A Clergyman's Daughter.
Right.
So everyone told me, look, leave that one for the end. It's garbage. Okay. This book is garbage. Do you know what? It's my favorite Orwell.
Well, he said the same thing about Northanger Abbey. And I think that's everyone's least favorite.
Yeah, it's the same as Northanger Abbey. The worst one is the best one. Because if you're looking for Orwell, you're not going to find him in this book, okay? Right. You're not going to find the character who's alone in the world and thinks what's going on in this dystopia. You're not going to get that. But if you're looking for Orwell pretending to be Dickens, then you're going to get a lot of that in A Clergyman's Daughter.
Right.
We talked last time about Orwell was a fan of Dickens. And this is essentially just him pretending to be Dickens. Now, I should say that it's not amazingly well written. It's split up into five sections and there's just a time jump as you go from one section to another. And there's not really good explanations for what's going on. You kind of have to piece things together a little bit. But I'll give you a quick flavor of it. So there's this girl, Dorothy. She is the clergyman's daughter and her dad is kind of a bad clergyman. He doesn't care about his congregation. He doesn't care that his church is falling apart. He's very miserly. He won't give her money to pay the bills. And, you know, she's asking for money. And he's saying, you've had all your allowance that you're getting this month.
Very Dickensian, yeah.
Yeah, but it's not her allowance. It's to pay the butcher. It's to pay for their food. Like, you know, and they're just not paying the tradesman. And he's outraged, you know. And he's like, are you not getting anything more from me? And there's a little bit of weird religious stuff where they seem to be something in between Protestant and Catholic. And I didn't really understand exactly what their faith was, but it's not really important, to be honest.
Yeah.
Suffice to say, they don't like any of the other churches and they just kind of do their own thing. And Dorothy goes around like very religious, praying all the time, pricking herself if she has impure thoughts. And, you know, there's a bit of sort of puritanical type things as well. And they don't, you know, they're not allowed to worship nature. They're not allowed to worship basically anything. He doesn't like, he's not even really that fond of praying. It's very strange, you know, but that's fine. That's by the by. That all happens in the first part. And there's this one chap and he basically decides he's a womanizer and he's got all these like illegitimate kids and he goes around and meeting girls in all these different places. And he decides he likes Dorothy, like this pure, chaste clergyman's daughter who's never been with any man. And he just continually tries to force himself on her. And she's like pushing him away and hitting him away. It's a little bit difficult to read in parts when we get to that.
Okay.
He's called Mr. Warburton. And he's like sneaking around and saying, oh, you've got such lovely arms. And, you know, how are you not married with such lovely arms and all this kind of stuff. Okay. And there's an old gossip.
Wouldn't like to have him in a party.
No. And there's an old gossip and they're worried that she'll see them together. Then we move on to part two and we wake up in a dream and Dorothy's wandering around senseless, not knowing who she is or where she is. And it's what happened? This is a weird time jump. What's going on? And then she meets these pure Dickensian chaps and they're like homeless chaps and they're going to work on some fields. and they're saying things like, that's the Mulligatawny, and all these little Cockney type things, and Dorothy joins in with them, and they're saying, oh, I've just got to stop and put the nail back into my shoe, that's the Mulligatawny, and all this kind of stuff, and it's quite funny, and they're talking about their half crowns and everything, and
I like the sound of it.
It's a good one, man. They go and they do some work in the fields.
Yeah.
And there's a long sections of them just working in the fields with these poor people, and they're sleeping in hay. But they sing songs, and they sing songs like "'Twas Christmas Day in the Workhouse," and very depressing songs like that. And then they see a newspaper about the rector's daughter and how she went off, and they think she's gone off with this Mr. Warburton in a passionate scandal because he's left the town at the same time. But she doesn't remember who she is at the start. She remembers later.
Hmm.
But she's seeing these pictures of the rector's daughter, and she doesn't know that it's her. And then we have another weird jump where the chap that she's with gets arrested. We have another weird jump, and now she's homeless, and she goes to her uncle, some rich uncle, and he gets her a job in a school. So now she's in a school, and it's very Dickensian school. Like, it's taken out of, I can't remember which Dickens it is. Is it Nicholas Nickleby, maybe? One of the Dickenses that has, like, the traditional little school. Okay. And this is the teacher, and she's always saying things like, you know, we don't care about educating the kids' minds, we just care about the profit. So we make them copy out these pointless exercises to show to their parents so that the parents are happy. And this girl's trying to teach them things. She's like, these kids are all brain dead idiots because no one's ever taught them anything. And she teaches them geography and makes maps with them. And she teaches them, you know, history, and she brings in books, and she brings in Shakespeare. And the parents come in and complain, and they say, what's this dirty text? What's this Shakespeare? Someone told me this is high literature, but there's filth in it, and I will not have my child learning this Shakespeare filth.
Roman Juliet, it's very influential. No, teens read that; they get some.
And they starve this poor girl, even though she's a teacher. Like, they barely let her eat any food in the house. Everyone's starving and poor. You know, it's very Dickensian. And in the end, she gets a big telling off.
Don't tell me, dude.
No, no. Well, I mean, in the end of this section,
okay.
She gets a big telling off for what happened in the school, and you know, at one point she's staying in a brothel that she kind of doesn't realize is a brothel because she's so innocent. and then it gets weird because there's just a big section which is like, do you know the way sometimes in a book, a character will walk past a few people and they'll give you a few snippets of their conversation. Mm. You might get a few lines that's a snippets of conversation. Now I imagine that those few lines last for 30 pages. Okay, so there's just like an entire section of the book that's just fragments of like 10 different people's conversation, and it's all over the place. Wow. And it doesn't make any sense, and it just goes on and on and on. It's very, very strange.
It's obviously very influenced by Ulysses, because that's what happened to Ulysses in the whole book. It's just fragments of conversations, and like when I read it, there was literally 100 pages. There was one point in the middle where there's 100 pages I couldn't understand. And very fragmentary, and especially that a dream scene is like the nighttown scene in Ulysses.
Mm.
So it's like near the end, it's kind of becomes very mad and it's very dream-esque. People get arrested, all kinds of stuff happening, and they're also in a brothel. So it just it sounds like he's kind of pastiching some modern authors he likes and Dickens. It sounds like a very kind of this sounds like he's just experimenting truly.
I think he was, yeah.
And whereas the other ones was like, this is my kind of thing, but now I just want to make something completely different.
Yeah. But the strangest thing is this, you know, it's a 30-page segment of fragmented dialogue, and then it just moves on from that. Like, it just doesn't fit the rest of the book, really. And, you know, it's all these different characters, and they're all homeless, they're sleeping in the streets, and there's like 20 of them piled on top of each other for warmth. And the policeman keeps coming along and saying, stop making that noise, or I'll send you to your homes. It's like, well, they don't have any homes. That's why they're in the street. You can't tell them off for being in the street and say.
So is it being very, you know, it's basically a parody kind of a.
It is a little a bit,
farce,
yeah.
A farce
kind of. And it's farcical. It's just when the policeman is just like, you know, if you're going to keep on being unsightly out here, I shall have to force you to return to your homes.
I'd love to read it. That sounds great.
It's a really good one. And then, you know, there's all these Dickens type characters as well. One of the women's like, oh, I don't want to go see my husband because, you know, one black eye in a week's enough for me and all this kind of stuff. Yeah, so it's. Yeah, all the usual, but I'm not going to give away the ending. Like we generally never do, but basically, it's quite sad because there's two possibilities for the ending, and that and neither of them I don't think are happy. One route is that she essentially goes back to her dad and just continues with her boring life that she didn't really like, now that she's lost her religious belief anyway. And the second option is that she goes with the sex predator, Mr. Warburton, and marries him. Like, those are the two options that are presented.
Well, as usual,
and she kind of has
William
to, yeah, like pick like which one is the least awful, you know? So that's A Clergyman's Daughter, but it's a really, really fun one to read, even though it's a bit erratic and the different sections seem to not relate to each other. The characters are good. It's essentially Orwell thinking, what if I was Dickens instead of Orwell? And then he wrote that. You know?
Oh, I like that, actually. I like that idea. I'd love to read it.
It's a nice one. And why don't you tell us about what you've read, PJ?
So I've read... yes, I've been keeping it minimal, indeed, this month. But here is a slim novel, kind of a novella. It's called The Heron and the Violet Flower. And in Spanish is La Garza y la Violeta by Rafael Arozarena. So kind of like, it sounds like it's saying Rafael Rice Sand, with a slight different spelling. And he is a Canarian novelist.
Ah.
So for those of you who don't know, I was born in the Canaries and raised here and in Ireland. And he was born in the island next to mine. I'm in Gran Canaria. He was born in Tenerife in 1923. And he's basically kind of a modern respected author. So particularly around the, I think, 50s or so onwards. And this is one of his latter novels. It's quite short. The Heron and the Violet. It tells a story. It's very short, but it's quite a bit of an epic feeling. It reminds me of some Latin American novels like 100 Years of Solitude in some sense, even though it's not generational, it's only just the perspective of one boy. But basically, it's about this boy living in basically what's Tenerife, with the Teide Mountain, so it's the biggest volcano in Spain. But it's told very almost kind of, especially at the beginning, it's told almost mythical. It's not so clear, actually, that it's this island. And only later do you find out it's the Canary Islands. But it starts off with this Montaña de Cristales. It's like a crystal mountain. And that if anyone who goes there will never come back. And his mother died near the top and is buried in snow. And that violets grow on the snow. That's the violet reference. So he just imagined his mother died there, and he just imagines her corpse kind of frozen but beautifully intact with violets growing on top when it's not snowing. Mm-hmm. But it's basically him and like kind of like he's not actually clear how old he is, but it's implied that he's a teenager. But sometimes it's a perspective of a little boy. And it's very vague it's very vague in which time setting, what the age is, who the people are. It's very vague in that sense. It's almost fairy tale-esque. And I love that kind of storytelling. And it's about him and living with his father and grandmother in a kind of a rundown place at the base of the mountain. And they're very sad. They used to have a banana plantation, and there used to be glorious days of bananas, like having adventures in the banana plantation. And now he's stuck with his grandmother and dad, and the dad is just looking into the glass of wine and not talking. And it's all very sad, to be honest. And then we find out that he has a friend. And this friend is a girl. And we, you know, her name is Maggie. But we think that Maggie is his love interest for a while.
Okay.
Right, that's what you expect. And yeah, he's quite obsessed with Maggie, and he mentions Maggie and the mother, La Señora Milton. So Mrs. Milton, so they're an English family, and they've kind of go back and forth between Gran Canaria, Tenerife and Britain. And we think that he's obsessed with Maggie and that he just wants to meet her, and his aunt is taking care of the house while they're gone, and he goes to visit the aunt and actually wants to see the family. But we soon find out that it's not actually It's not actually Maggie. He's interested in. It's Mrs. Milton.
Ooh.
So if it comes, if a bit of a twist, can't say much more than that and where it leads. But a bit of a, you know, a bit of a Mrs. Robinson twist going on there in the Canary Islands. And not just that, but all of a sudden, it was a bit random, I found. I was a bit slightly disappointed about this because I like vague sort of things. And became very specific then. He particularly wants to be a tennis champion. And it seemed a bit random, to be honest, because I thought it was starting off very mythical, sort of like this.
That's a bit unusual, yeah.
Yes, and because for me, it brought it into a specific time frame. Because all of a sudden, the woman, she's modern, all of a sudden it seemed clear that it must be the 70s around that time, because like tennis started to become popular, British people in Canary Islands, and he's not interested anymore in that kind of, his uncle is a fisherman, his dad used to be a banana plantation, he wants to be the best tennis player in the world, and guess what? Mrs. Milton did win the award for best female tennis player, I think. And he kind of wants to beat that. He kind of wants to be the champion himself. He wants to own that house, because here's a second twist. I'm not going to say more. The house where Mrs. Milton lives, that whole area used to be owned by the boy's family. Spooky. So that's where he used to live, and where the banana plantation used to live, it used to be. But now it's owned by Mrs. Milton, who he's obsessed with. Okay. And the idea is that, okay, he's obsessed with her, and is it love? Well, I can't say. But at the same time, she kind of took away his home. She didn't really, but that's the way he kind of sees it. That the land she's on now used to be his, and he feels like he kind of owns it, but yet there's also feelings for the family. And the book is all about that conflict, to be honest, that the Canary Islands have, that tourism and a lot of foreign people coming there. And to be honest, half the population here is not Spanish.
Yeah.
And it's a bit of a conflict between like that loss of identity, because it used to be agriculture and fish industry, and now it's all about tourism. And it's a bit about that as well, that, you know, the Canary
person. PJ, what about the prime Canarian business, the Donald Burger?
The what?
The Donald Burger. Well, remember, we used the Donald Duck burger joint.
Oh, yeah, exactly. I know which one. Yeah, the Pepito Chiringo. Exactly. Yeah, so that's basically the twist, isn't it? The end of the story. So, look, all I can say about this book is read Rafael Arroz Arena if you want to get into some prime Canarian literature. If I had written it, I would have focused more on the first part about the mom and like the mountains. It seemed more mythical. I enjoyed that kind of story. And it became more realistic later on. Mm. So mixed feelings about the book, but generally I would still recommend it. But anyway, and there's a connection between, yeah, there's obviously a lot of Freud and things going on. The mom reminds him. He all of a sudden he sees the kind of similarity between Mrs. Milton and his mother, who he barely remembers anyway. But the aunt keeps saying, "Oh, they look so similar, don't they? They look so similar." So it's this kind of, there's a bit of a Freudian kind of twist going on there, obviously. But I enjoyed the mythical kind of mountain background, and that always kind of hanging over him. I always enjoyed that kind of stuff in a book. So yeah, give it a read. That's one of the things I read. And Dean, I really wanted to hear.
That's awesome.
And you've read two books, which we're going to talk about now, which I'm really excited about, because those are...
I'm going to get to those in a little moment.
Those are exciting.
But I have a little segue. So I thought that you also read some comics. Do you want to briefly just mention those?
I do indeed, yes. I know your opinion of comics, Dean. I'm amused at your kind of... I can hear the neutrality, forced neutrality in your voice.
I told you off mid-month. I told you off for watching Spider-Man.
Exactly, you did. So that's what you did. Well, guys, I do want to tell you, because that's my part of the show, that I've been setting old Spidey aside and having go Daredevil. Have you ever read Daredevil, Dean, or watched any of the films?
I did actually see one of the films. Yeah,
really. Okay, and I can see from your
I'm not very very big on it.
Well, look, guys, all I can say is give it a read. I started reading I think I'm on comic number 7, the original, the first volume ever of Daredevil, which is really, actually fantastic. I love it, especially the first comic. So it loses its way a slightly bit. It becomes a bit silly at times, but the first comic is really
the comics become the cartoon fellows in the comics become silly.
Well,
I would never guess that now.
Well, that's a twisting. Yeah, that's a good thing. And he wears a yellow costume. Actually, he wears a yellow costume.
He was red.
Yeah, no, he wears a yellow costume to like volume 7, 8, which is a bit distracting. But to be honest, like I still think it's a great concept. It's a great concept. Okay. A blind person. So it's basically he's blind and using all his other senses mm-hmm. to combat crime. Come on, you gotta love that. And he pretends to be like a gullible kind of lawyer in his free time. I love that. I think
it's certainly written content. Yeah.
Well, there you go. So this is me. That's my recommendation. Give it a read, guys.
Cool. The reason I wanted you to mention it now is because I didn't read a comic, but I read an Orwell essay about a comic.
And what did you say about the comics?
Well, he was reading. So I didn't know that there was such a thing as good comics, but apparently there are. He was reading these English comics, The Magnet and the Gem, and he said they were out of fashion even then. And it's about all these people in these old, like, Eton type schools and a lot of little posh boys and doing pranks on their teacher. And it's Billy Bunter and all these chaps going around. And it sounds brilliant. You know, I thought, it's a lot of posh little English kids. This is amazing, you know. And he said, all these American comics with their violence. Oh, we don't need those in Britain. We've got, you know, Billy Bunter and so forth. And the glamour of public school life, you know. And he says these schools are all founded in the 16th century, you know. And there's a funny bit where he says, look, these comics have been going on, The Gem and The Magnet, for 30 years. And The Gem was written by Frank Mitchell and The Magnet by someone else. And he says, obviously, you know, this is a pen name. And a lot of different people have written over the years. And then he's a little asterisk where he's, but I've just received correspondence from Frank Mitchell to tell me that no, he did actually write all of those for 30 years. And the guy who wrote The Gem, that's also him with his fake name. So he wrote both of them for 30 years.
Oh, really? Oh my God. Yes. That's bad.
It's quite funny that he put that little addendum, like, no, sorry, I've just been told off for that.
So hold on a second. So this is the guy who created Billy Bunter.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I love Billy Bunter. Have you ever read any of
Actually never read any. So also, you know them good. And are they good? Would I like them?
Well, I didn't think they're comics. They're just comic novels. But anyway, Billy Bunter is. I loved it as a kid. I have to have a try again. Once, like, it's ridiculous stuff. It's P.G. Woodhouse. It's P.G. Woodhouseian, I would say, but slightly more grotesque because Billy Bunter is. It's all about like it's. It's almost praising gluttony. You know, it's almost praising the fact that he just eats too much. And it's very absurd. But he gets into situations and into all kinds of ridiculous kind of situations. He can't help being amused. But I would say it's pretty politically incorrect nowadays. That's the only thing.
Okay.
Yeah, I think, you know, some people in the health industry might have a thing to say about being
okay. Right. Well, you know, they sounded more appealing to me than the American comics that have taken over. And I very, very quickly read another essay about postcard artwork. And really? I only bring it up briefly because it gives us an idea, a little insight into the typical life that Orwell talks about in his books. They stand for the worm's eye view of life, for the music hall world where marriage is a dirty joke or a comic disaster, where the rent is always behind, the clothes are always up the spout, the lawyer is always a crook. The Scotsman is always a miser. The newlyweds make fools of themselves on hideous beds in seaside lodging houses. And the drunken red-nosed husbands roll home at 4 in the morning to meet the linen nightgowned wives who wait behind the door with a poker in their hand. That's the tip. That describes perfectly the world in, like, Coming Up for Air and Keep the Aspid Easter Flying and most of these Orwell novels. So I just thought it was a nice little aside. But look, I did read two more books and I discovered that they're two of your favorite books and we're going to get to those in just a second. But first, I'm going to play a quick, it's only a minute and a half. It was sent in by a fan. It's Erland from the podcast Well That Aged Well.
My book recommendation is Berlin Diaries by William Shirer. It's a non-fiction book, but it's not really a classic in the sense of being classic like you just do. I'm sorry about that, but it's one of the reasons I want to recommend this book is because William Shriver firsthand experienced what it was like to be in Nazi Germany. And he was a experienced oppression, and he writes about this in his diary. And you get to see what it's like to live in under the Nazi regime from an American correspondent. And he's one of the pioneers of corresponding as well. So his story is super fascinating, and I don't see why Hollywood hasn't made this a movie yet, because it really should be. Every page is a page-turner. And it's you get his own regards of the view of the Nazi regime under while the Nazis were at the height of its power. And I don't have anything but recommendation for this book. So that's my recommendation. My Instagram is well.h2well. And my podcast is well.h2well.
There we go. Thank you, Ireland. From Well That Aged Well, history podcast, with his recommendation for us. And we did a crossover with him before. I did an episode about the Odyssey, if you remember,
indeed,
a while back.
Yeah. And I've heard of this book, and it's supposed to be really good. The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich. Yeah, I've heard of it. So it is supposed to be kind of a quintessential book about the history of Nazi Germany, and the fact that an American journalist wrote it, I always think makes it better, because it just seems a more slightly objective perspective. I don't want to read it. You know, I want to read that more than from a German historian. It's slightly less emotional, I feel. And this guy lived also in Europe, so he kind of knows his stuff, as far as I know. I haven't read it though yet. Thanks for that recommendation.
Thank you. And while we're paused, I should say, guys, if you want more of us, because people are saying to me, PJ, we're getting these messages, and the people are saying, I really wish we had things like, you know, Shakespeare reviews, Agatha Christie reviews, people talking about ancient Greek court speeches. Very specific request, ancient Greek court speeches, 10-year-old interviews.
Yeah, there's been specific requested to do a review of the show. What's the show again with Richard Ayoade?
Yes, we had people asking for Garth Marenghi's Dark Place. So, guys, it's all on the Patreon.
Patreon.com/booksboys.
No travel man. So the first episode's out, but we're about to record the fifth. There's only going to be six. There's a limited series of six episodes. I conscripted my friend Robert to do it with me, and it's called Dark Place Dreamers, and we review the ridiculous 2004 show Garth Marenghi's Dark Place, which is a bunch of guys pretending that they made a show in the 80s, which was a hospital drama horror show where they open the gates of hell, and there's like a monster of the week type thing, and they've all got shotguns, but they're in a hospital. It's very weird. And there's a lot of cool 80s synth music, and it's terribly made, and you can see the strings on the things and the camera cuts. And you've got Matt Berry and Richard Ayoade, and cameos from people like Noel Fielding and Julian Barrett. And it's the best show I've ever seen in my entire life. I think it was made just for me, but it's also ridiculous. And I think anybody else who watched it would think it was awful. So we reviewed the first episode. Well, the first episode is already out. We've also got 10-year-old interviews from The Vault with Susan Lee Picking's episode just came out. A lovely little singer-songwriter. And we talked about her album, Wander in the Wander. And then we also had a couple more episodes of the Greek court speeches. That's Forensic Friends. And PG, I think if we have time, we will do a Playboys soon. So there's plenty of stuff on the Patreon. So hopefully everyone wants to check that out. And if it was any cheaper, we'd be paying you, you know. So.
Yeah. So go ahead, guys, and give it a try.
That's it. PJ, the next two books I've read, I feel very strange, by the way, because I normally keep my pile of books with me. Little Alfred normally guides them for me.
Well, that's well, don't worry, Dean, because I've got your books right here in front of me. Good. The books you're mentioning.
I do have one of them, but the other one, a mutual friend of ours lent me, and I've given it back to him.
Indeed.
And all the Herodotus books I've given back to the library. So I'm sitting here with just Orwell, really. But I've got this one, Relato de un Náufrago by Gabriel García Márquez. Now, I did a tour of the world here, PJ.
A tale of a ship cast, right? Indeed, not just that, but we are holding the same edition.
We're holding the exact same edition on the cam. We've got a mirrored webcams now.
Exactly.
But I should just mention quickly, because we're about to go to South America for this one. The next one's going to take us to Japan. We've been in England. We've been in ancient Greece. This is like an episode of Feel Good Hit of the Summer, man. Oh, we're that's good all around, you know?
That's another one for the vault right there. Check it out, guys.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.